Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with Benjamin Beilman, ahead of his Philadelphia Chamber Music Society recital debut. David Patrick Stearns checks in with Christoph Eschenbach as the former Philadelphia Orchestra music director undertakes an ambitious three-week-long festival in his second season in charge at the National Symphony Orchestra. And Susan Lewis takes us to the Philadelphia Museum of Art for an exhibition of the product designs of one of the world's leading architects, Zaha Hadid. That's all ahead this morning on Creatively Speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
22-year-old violinist Benjamin Beilman will graduate from the Curtis Institute of Music later this year, having been at the school since he was 17. During most of his time in Philadelphia, he's been represented by Astral Artists, the non-profit advocacy organization for promising young musicians. Thanks to Astral, Beilman has had multiple opportunities to hone his performance skills by giving regular recitals in schools and retirement communities. This is now standing him in good stead. The calendar for his post-conservatory career is filling out nicely. He made his New York City recital debut earlier this month, with Boston to follow in May. He's a headliner at this year's Astral Rising Stars concert with the Symphony in C at the Kimmel Center in April, and he's the soloist for the Brahms Violin Concerto with Montreal's Orchestra Metropolitain in June under Yannick Nezet-Séguin. Tomorrow afternoon, he'll make his official Philadelphia recital debut in a Chamber Music Society of Philadelphia concert at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. This is being advertised as your Philadelphia recital debut, but it's far from that. You have done many, many recitals under the auspices of Astral and even off your own bat in the Philadelphia area. Can you tell us a little bit about why you were so active with doing a lot of these performances?
I use a lot of these recitals, you know, through Astral. I visit a lot of retirement communities, schools. These are very, very important opportunities for me to try out recital programs, new pieces, new types of pieces. I think last summer I presented a couple concerts where I played through all 24 Paganini caprices. And so obviously that's not something that you want to do on a huge stage the first time. So very appreciative audiences at these retirement homes were the perfect people to play this music for. The concert tomorrow is very important for me, and there's a very strong connection because I'm presenting it under the auspices of the Philadelphia Chamber Music Society, and I have a long relationship with Tony Cecchia, you know, the head of PCMS, and a lot of the people there, because obviously there's that joint relationship with the Marlborough Music Festival, and I've spent, you know, 4 summers up there as a participant. So this is very, very important for me to feel like it's a sort of homecoming, I guess.
It is very much a homecoming, but a side benefit of all those recitals that you were doing in retirement communities is that you were also building reputation.
Absolutely. You know, I'm a student at Curtis, and I'm graduating in May, and I've been here for the past 5 years. And one of the great things about being based in Philadelphia is I feel like there's such a strong connection to its own artists and its own people in the community. So yeah, absolutely. Through Astral and through Curtis, I really feel like I've gotten to know a lot of very important people and very common people, you know, the people that are really making up every single audience in Philadelphia.
Recently, you made your New York recital debut. You'll be doing Boston soon. And then there's the small matter of a Brahms violin concerto with a rather obscure French-Canadian conductor later in the summer. Tell us about playing, or how it came about that you would be playing the Brahms Violin Concerto with Yannick Nezet-Séguin in Montreal.
I had the incredible fortune of winning a major international violin competition in June 2010, and that was held in Montreal. And that competition is every 3 years for violin, so it's one of the big ones. Luckily, winning that put my name sort of on the map, especially within the Canadian realm of classical music.
So it wasn't a Philadelphia connection at all, then?
Not directly. The concert is sort of a product of winning the competition, and I performed with the Orchestra Metropolitain, which obviously is Yannick's orchestra, and he wasn't conducting during the competition, but I played with a lot of the orchestra musicians, and I guess they had spoken to Yannick and said, you got to hear this guy. We would love to play with him again. So I was very lucky. I got the call to ask me to play. I guess they're having a Brahms festival. They're doing a bunch of the symphonies. And so, you know, obviously this is a dream completely come true, to play with a fantastic orchestra, with one of the most inspiring, and I've worked with him as a Curtis Orchestra member, but one of the most inspiring musicians of our time, playing, you know, a warhorse piece of the repertoire. So this is definitely very exciting.
A warhorse piece that happens to be by one of the potentially most influential conductors of our time, favorite composers.
Yes, yeah. So it's...
Any pressure?
No, not in the slightest. No. Yeah, obviously, I've performed the Brahms a few times before, all with the idea that it's leading up to this big concert in June. And yeah, I guess it's kind of a perfect storm of excitement and a little bit of anxiety, too.
We were talking before we started recording about the path for young musicians and how it is actually getting more competitive and possibly with fewer opportunities than it was even 10 years ago. You're represented in Philadelphia by Astral and by another not-for-profit agency in New York. What's the path forward for you now? Because things are happening slowly, but they're happening less slowly than they are for other people of your age.
Sure. I'm very aware. You know, I see some of my colleagues, and they have sort of skyrocket careers, which is fantastic. And I admire them, and they have something very different to offer than I do. For me...
Well, my point was actually that you're probably maybe doing a lot better than many people of your age.
Maybe some, but you know, obviously there's always people to compare yourself to. There's always someone who's better than you, more advanced, more, you know, famous, you know, things that really shouldn't matter. And obviously young artists always have an eye on that, including myself, but that's definitely not my primary focus. I've had a lot of direction from my mentors saying, you know, really establish your foundation musically, personally, and just figure out what you want to say before you really launch yourself out there. And I've been lucky. I mean, Astral, young concert artists in New York, and Curtis have been so instrumental in me establishing these connections. I look forward to bigger concerts, you know, more exposure, but more than anything, I'm just kind of taking it one day at a time, trying to figure out the different repertoire, what I want to say with it, and just finding my own voice.
How ready are you for what happens next? I mean, give me an example of how many concertos do you have in your fingers at one time, or is that kind of thing important? How much repertoire do you need to be carrying with you so that when the next opportunity shows up, you're there for whatever's needed?
Ideally, and I've talked to a couple of soloists who are really making it today, and they say that you should have anywhere between about 6 concertos and 12 or 13, and very often, you know, one of the concertos is a new concerto or one that's not played very often. Also, a sort of template that people use is they usually have one recital program, you know, a full 80, 90-minute recital program in their fingers for one season, and they play just that program, but, you know, 6 to 12 concertos. So at any given time, you need to have 3 to 5 hours of music completely memorized in your fingers, ready to go at any moment.
And if somebody calls from, I don't know, San Francisco tomorrow and says, somebody is taken ill and we need you for X concerto that's not in your fingers, is that possible? Could that be done in a week? I mean, how ready do you need to be for opportunities that you weren't expecting?
I don't know if it's the most logical thing to agree to if you don't know the concerto, but hopefully by the time you graduate a conservatory, or even, honestly, a lot of times people try and learn the major concertos by the end of high school. Ideally, you should have major concertos in your fingers so that when someone does call in sick, you can jump at it. But again,
it's revision rather than learning.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you're revisiting, you're just repolishing. You've gotten all the fundamentals down. But I've been lucky. The advice that I've been given was there's no shame in turning a concert like that down. If they're interested in having you, hopefully they'll invite you in a future season if you can't do that immediate concert.
Tell me about your schedule at the moment in terms of attending Curtis, how much time you're spending practicing, and then how you'll maintain that discipline and that structure after you graduate, after you don't have to show up and do what you're supposed to do.
This is my 5th and final year at Curtis. I'll graduate with a bachelor's degree, and typically you can do that in 4 years, but Curtis is very lenient in allowing people to stay in an additional year, which for me is very important because this is my year of continuing to polish these main pieces that I will be performing for the rest of my life while still studying certain classes at Curtis, but, you know, traveling around. I'm taking a cadenza writing class, which is extremely helpful. Very often performers have this kind of phobia of even starting to write a cadenza for a Mozart concerto or Brahms or Beethoven. So that's been very helpful as a class. Fortunately, a lot of the teachers are very lenient in letting me leave. You know, often I'll be gone from Thursday till Tuesday. So I'll miss at least one of the classes per week. And I try and keep up via email. They've been great in helping me out. But yeah, I mean, this kind of diligence and discipline is absolutely needed. You finish a concert, you know, on let's say a Saturday, and you can't take a day off. If you take a day off, you're already a day behind for the next performance, which could be 2 days later, a day later. Fortunately, I'm young enough and I have enough energy that I don't need these huge chunks of time as a break. But yeah, you really have to stay driven.
And do you have certain, I guess what singers would call sing in the shower composers, are there certain composers that come easier to you than others?
I don't think anything really comes easy. I think it takes a lot of work and a lot of digging, but I find myself listening a lot to Schubert, not just the violin pieces, you know, piano, Lieder, Brahms as well. Brahms, to me, feels very good in my fingers. I mean, it feels like you can dig in and you can really produce anything you want while not losing and sacrificing whatever's in the music.
And then other music. You talked about writing cadenzas, but have you played any jazz, tried any improvisation? What's on your iPod, for instance?
Basically everything except for country. I have, you know, reggae, I have jazz, I have Frank Sinatra, I have, yeah, Dr. Dre. I mean, it's kind of a full mix of things, but mostly I listen to classical music. That's what I've fallen in love with, and that's what I like to listen to most.
Benjamin Beilman. He makes his Philadelphia Chamber Music Society recital debut at the Van Pelt Auditorium at the Philadelphia Museum of Art tomorrow afternoon at 3. He'll perform the Brooke First Violin Concerto with Symphony in C at the Kimmel Center's Perelman Theatre on Monday, April 2nd at 7:30.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Leila Bartok's depiction of urban street traffic in his ballet The Miraculous Mandarin also describes the hectic life of the man who is conducting it, the former Philadelphia Orchestra music director Christoph Eschenbach. He's now in his second season as music director of the National Symphony Orchestra in Washington, D.C., and is in the midst of a festival titled The Music of Vienna, Budapest, and Prague. This week he conducts Beethoven's opera Fidelio in its first version, titled Leonora, and goes on to the Dvorak Stabat Mater next week. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns visited the Kennedy Center last week for Eschenbach's All Bartok concert and wondered why such things never happened in Philadelphia.
Whenever he was in Philadelphia, Christoph Eschenbach was one of the busiest musicians in town, conducting both the Philadelphia Orchestra and the Curtis Symphony Orchestra, and, during his last guest conducting visit here, playing chamber music at the Art Alliance less than an hour before conducting at the Kimmel Center. The difference in Washington is that the events, at least in the current weeks, have bigger budgets and could be riskier box office. But he can do that. Eschenbach also holds the title of Kennedy Center Music Director since, as he explained the other day on the phone, the two organizations are run under the same administrative umbrella.
We don't swim in money, but for sure not. But the National Symphony, because it's part of the Kennedy Center, is rather safe in its financial and economic situation. It's also terribly well managed, both the Kennedy Center and the orchestra. So we are in a good situation here.
It would also seem that there are fewer people to say no to him, and the one person with veto power apparently hasn't been using it. That's Michael Kaiser, president of the Kennedy Center, who no doubt had some influence in Eschenbach's initial 3-year contract with the National Symphony Orchestra being extended by 2 years last September, and didn't balk at the notion of Beethoven's full-length Leonora in a semi-stage presentation.
Mr. Kaiser was very much into that opera in concert version.
Neither did the orchestra balk at the heavy schedule,
which is very demanding for the orchestra and for me also. And I'm very glad to say that when I came here 2 days ago and began to rehearse the Bartok program, everybody was so well prepared that the rehearsals were easy.
The why didn't this happen in Philadelphia question doesn't have an easy answer. Eschenbach's 5-year tenure from 2003 to 2008 happened before last spring's Philadelphia International Festival of the Arts, which created a precedent for that kind of programming, the sort that incoming music director Yannick Nézet-Séguin has lost no time instituting with this June's tribute to Leopold Stokowski. Eschenbach says he wasn't stymied in Philadelphia. He did, after all, conduct complete cycles of Beethoven and Mahler symphonies. However, the Kennedy Center has a tradition of mid-season festivals, and Eschenbach believes in their larger importance, even though they may be busting the budget.
It concentrates the mind of the audience in a wonderful way. And, you know, this festival of Prague, Vienna, Budapest is, of course, I mean, the cradle of music. And therefore, we have so many ideas, of which I'm very proud that we could put many of them into reality.
One of the highlights of this festival is Eschenbach's singers. They aren't just good, but have big personalities. Even if they don't entirely work out, you still want to hear them, such as Matthias Gern in Bartók's Bluebeard's Castle. Amid those performances, Eschenbach also accompanied Gern on piano in performances of Schubert's song cycle Winterreise while shuttling in and out of Boston and New York to conduct the Boston Symphony Orchestra. You didn't hear him complaining, though.
These kind of things interest me and keep me young.
Yes. If they don't kill you.
No.
Yeah, but...
The contrary.
Though Christoph Eschenbach's Philadelphia years weren't considered a great success, they were full of excellent music making, the evidence being this recording of Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 6. But I often thought that Philadelphia wasn't experiencing the best of him. The Eschenbach that I saw at the Chicago Symphony's Ravinia Festival, which he used to direct, and the New York Philharmonic, where I observed a high-velocity rehearsal, were less in evidence in Philadelphia. On stage, there were nights when Eschenbach seemed to be trying too hard, as if he had to extract the music from the orchestra rather than release it. Also, his long mid-season absences for the likes of Wagner's Ring Cycle in Paris did not help any. In Washington, Eschenbach seems to be in the groove. Part of the challenge there is to find a personality for an orchestra that has always risen well to the grand occasion, but habitually sounded astringent under past music director Mstislav Rostropovich and reportedly lackluster under his successor, Leonard Slatkin. In other words, Eschenbach is back in a situation that's parallel to his finest hour, the Houston Symphony Orchestra, where his deep community involvement made a lasting difference both with the orchestra and with the public. In fact, he stands to give Washington, D.C.'s symphonic public a depth of culture that it has known only intermittently. The question is if the public has the taste to truly hear it. At the All Bartók program, the audience response was enthusiastic, but I also saw a fair number of empty seats.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. The designs of the Iraqi-born British architect Zaha Hadid are changing urban landscapes around the world, from railway stations to office towers to cultural centres. The Guangzhou Opera House in China, Maxi, the National Museum of 21st Century Art in Rome, and the Riverside Museum of Transport in Glasgow in Scotland are among recently completed works. Current projects include the Aquatic Centre for London's 2012 Olympic Games. Hadid's many honours include the European Union Prize for Contemporary Architecture, the Sterling Prize, and what is sometimes described as the Nobel Prize for Architecture, the Pritzker. Hadid's London-based firm, now grown to over 300 people from 45 different countries, also designs smaller-scale products. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis explores an exhibition at the Philadelphia Museum of Art's Perelman Building that celebrates Hadid's work, with her product designs displayed in a setting created by the architect.
In the Perelman's atrium, bathed in natural light, sits a car. Its clean lines and deceptively simple form, making it look like a cartoon vehicle or a child's toy, magically made life-sized. Perched on three wheels, its curvy white body gleams. Its jet-black windshield stretches up and over the top, doubling as a door. Manon Janssens, exhibition coordinator from Zaha Hadid's architectural firm, admits it's an unusual object to be designed by an architect, but it was a commission from a client.
I guess it starts as an exercise. So it's a prototype, what you see downstairs. It's not a functioning car, but the idea is really to have a car that works as a car.
The car stands still, but it's easy to imagine it in motion. The title of the exhibition, suggested by museum director Timothy Rubb, Form in Motion, seems apt.
Hadid's architecture, but also in her product design, is really about those two things, form and motion, and the kind of relationship she wants to establish between the two. And of course, that relationship is dynamic.
Encountering form in motion, says Rubb, is also the way people experience the world.
We always see the world in flux and change, not only because things themselves are changing, but also because we're always in motion ourselves in relation to objects, to rooms, to spaces.
In the nearby gallery are similarly sleek objects that relate to daily life. Made of materials ranging from steel and aluminum to fiberglass and polyurethane, tables, sofas, and other seating arrangements with asymmetrical forms, along with several items of jewelry, shoes, and tableware, are strategically placed in a setting created by the designer herself. A floor-to-ceiling, three-dimensional environment replete with curvy, undulating lines.
So there's no clear distinction between the actual installation and the actual objects, but they have to form a whole experience.
Except for two neon chandeliers, with colors continuously changing from blue to purple to green to yellow to orange to red, nearly everything in the installation is a shade of white or gray. Hadid firm senior architect Hemina Ariza says the goal is to create an immersive experience.
We aim for a seamless design in products. The exhibition or the installation itself, it really guides you through the space.
Fluidity, says Manon Janssens, is one of Hadid's key elements, used in products as well as some of the building designs for which the architect is famous, such as the Maxi Museum in Rome.
Where the visitor is invited to go through the space in a fluid way, so it's not divided into all different gallery spaces, but your visit should be a continuous one. And I think that is really reflected in this exhibition too. The visitor is drawn inside the space to go and explore further and further to end up into the video rooms.
The video room is an alcove with two screens, a large one showing Hadid's architectural projects from around the world with computer-generated, fast-moving designs, a smaller one showcasing a variety of her product designs. They demonstrate a convergence of art, design, and technology, says Eileen Tonini, chair of the group Colab, which supports the museum's design collection.
Her design statement is very painterly and artistic and very gestural. At the same time, it's powerful and it completely leverages all of the state-of-the-art technology and engineering that could possibly be of the moment.
Hadid has pushed the technical limits of what can be created further than any practicing architect and designer, says Philadelphia Museum of Art curator Kathy Hiesinger. Using digital design and direct-to-production technology, a computer-generated model is fed directly to a cutting device,
which cuts the material exactly according to the specifications that Hadid and company design. And that's really a very huge step forward, which takes design objects directly from the drawing board into three dimensions.
Hadid's designs are informed by her experiences growing up in Iraq in the 50s and 60s, her interest in nature, and her studies of mathematics at the American University of Beirut and architecture at London's Architectural Association School of Architecture.
Well, she relies on very complex geometries to make curves that you couldn't plot without such sophisticated math. And her design language, her formal language, is consistent, whether it's in a building or whether it's in tableware, in her use of these curving shapes that look like something out of the Jetsons.
What emerges from this complex and highly technical process are works that have a very natural feel to them. Some products have shapes and names that reference geological elements, such as the crevice vases or the crater table, which has little eruptions on its surface. The installation's three-dimensional curving wall calls to mind layers of rock in a canyon. Its placement along the south wall of the gallery, closest to the flowing Schuylkill River and the moving traffic along Pennsylvania Avenue, says Hiesinger, also reflects Hadid's approach to her architectural work.
For Hadid, context is very important. And I think when she does a building or a master plan of a city, she takes all of the surrounding physical, geographic, geological realities into her planning process.
A bit esoteric? To be sure. Connecting geological realities with some futuristic place to which fertile imagination has led. Architect Hemina Arisa says Hadid's designs explore utopian possibilities.
You can tell from her initial drawings, it's like kind of a magic point of view of architecture, of space, of objects. So we're used normally to the vertical walls and the horizontal ceilings, and that's a house or whatever space. And this, I mean, you can always expect more. And in fact, I think this is somehow what we do in the office and what she does with her design. It's kind of pushing boundaries to find something else, always to achieve something more exciting in beautiful shapes and amazing spaces.
Beautiful shapes, large and small, and amazing spaces that make us reconsider our surroundings. Zaha Hadid is a prolific artist who has created a powerhouse of architecture and design. Working with references to and reverence for the natural world, cutting-edge technology, and creative energy, she takes what she imagines and makes it come alive.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Zaha Hadid, Form in Motion, is at the Philadelphia Museum of Art's Perelman Building through March 25th. And that's our program for this week. You can hear an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony in C under music director Rossin Milanoff. The program's associate producer is Eric Brannan, our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.